This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea in for Anthony Brooks.
Oh, the Green Mountain Boys came down, 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 down from their green, green hills. For the sake of their freedom, their only, only joy, they came down from their green, green hills.
Okay, quick, Meghna, tell me everything that you remember from your, like, American History 101 about Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys.
Oh, geez, I'm afraid to actually admit this because I'm not sure I remember much, because when I hear you say Ethan Allen and Green Mountain Boys, all that rings through my head is high-end...
Don't say furniture.
High-end furniture and coffee. I'm sorry.
Well, according to a new biography, Ethan Allen was, among other things, a real estate tycoon, a philosopher, a commander of revolutionary forces, and depending on whether you lived in New Hampshire or New York at the time, he was either a freedom fighter or a terrorist. I found no mention about whether or not he made furniture, but anyway. What's clear from this book is that Ethan Allen qualifies as a founding father, up there with the likes of Sam Adams and Tom Paine, and his life had broad influence beyond just the state of Vermont, of which he is remembered to have essentially created, even though even that is a more complicated story. Joining us now to talk about that complicated story from the studios of Vermont Public Radio in Colchester is Willard Stern Randall, author of Ethan Allen, His Life and Times, the first comprehensive biography of Ethan Allen to be written in 50 years. Will Randall, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Give us just the Cliff's Notes version of Ethan Allen's life up to the point where he comes to Vermont. He was a troublemaker from a family of troublemakers, right?
Well, that's a New York point of view. Actually, his family had come over with the Puritan immigration, and they kept moving farther and farther into the mainland, into the frontier, founders of Hartford, Connecticut. Every generation started a new town or a new settlement. When he was 26 years old, he set up the first iron forge in Connecticut. It made canon as late as the Revolution. His problem was that he wouldn't take a back seat to the local clergy or officials. So actually, he was busted once for blasphemy because he used the name of Christ and the name of God in the same sentence. He got thrown out of two towns, one in Connecticut and Northampton. He actually had himself inoculated for smallpox when that was illegal. He stripped to the waist after a real estate settlement went sour and tried to beat up the fellow that didn't show up with any money. So he's basically read out, was the term, of two towns, one Salisbury, Connecticut, one in Northampton. And with a wife and children, he had to find a way to make a living. And he became a professional hunter in this empty place of Vermont. After the French left, it was wide open country. And he made a living for 4 years hunting for deer and trapping beaver, which his brothers turned into things they sold in their store. And he also explored Vermont and found the best real estate.
And at the time, this is the 1760s, and Vermont was disputed territory, right? Both New York and New Hampshire claimed it.
New Hampshire's royal governor, Benning Wentworth, had sold something like 107 charters, each one for a township 5 miles square, putting about $3 million, our money, into his pocket in filing fees as he went along, only to be outdone by New York, which was trying to sell the same land to the settlers who were already there for five times as much as that. So the settlers were caught in the middle as these royal officials lined their pockets.
And so eventually New York gets wise and disputes New Hampshire's titles in Vermont. They take it all the way to King George in England. And what happens?
Well, King George and his council said it really belongs to New York, but you can't push anybody off their land. These are good people. These are settlers. They're securing the land for the crown. New York then tried to evict them with sheriff's posses, and Ethan Allen actually went to the Supreme Court in New York with the best lawyer he could find and tried to dispute the evictions. It didn't work. So when he went back to Bennington, named after the man who had sold the land, he organized the town leaders of 29 settlements. He was a minor shareholder himself, but he said they can't push us around. We should organize. And they voted him commandant of this new thing, the Green Mountain Boys. Before the revolution came, there were over 2,000 men who were skilled hunters and fighters and raring to fight New York or anybody else.
So basically, this is a very unkind way to put this, but the way your book tells it, this is the way it struck me, is that the Green Mountain Boys, this is, you know, the largest paramilitary force on the continent, instrumental in the Revolutionary War, which we're going to talk about in a second. basically a band of guys mobilized to make sure that their, you know, Ethan Allen's real estate investments would pay off.
Well, I don't think they saw it that way. They saw him as this courageous guy who was helping them hold on to the land. These were poor people. These were not speculators. And Ethan Allen didn't own a lot of real estate at first.
But he bought it up, didn't he?
Eventually, he and his family bought it when nobody would pay any money for it because they couldn't get a clear title from either New York or New Hampshire. So his family acquired, I think, something like 200,000 acres eventually. But at the time, he was sort of writing in favor of the settlers and against New York, and selling pamphlets as he came through your clearing, as selling you a pamphlet or a piece of real estate. It was small time, but he was seen as a hero. New York declared him an outlaw, and if he were captured, he could be strung up right at the time without a trial. So he was the Robin Hood of his time on the frontier between New Hampshire and New York.
And you also write that there was a key question in this little war over Vermont about whether or not this territory that we call Vermont now would have a New England identity versus a New York identity.
And that's a big question, because a New England identity, such as New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, meant that people could buy their land outright, not have to pay rent on it after they bought it the way you did in New York. It was theirs, and they could pass it down to their children. In New York, you had major landowners owning thousands and thousands of acres, and the people who worked the land were little better than serfs. They were indentured tenant farmers. They could never own anything. They couldn't improve the land. They had no incentive to do anything except work hard and get a night's sleep and go back to work the next morning.
Well, now we're catching up to what people might remember about Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys, which is that they went on to fight and win a key battle in the early days of the Revolution. Remind us of that.
Well, when the Revolution began at Lexington and Concord, the New England troops had no artillery, no cannon. The British had all the cannon down on their ships in Boston Harbor. Ethan Allen heard about this and said, I know where we can get a lot of very good artillery. Well, the French left it behind in their forts on Lake Champlain, and I have the men. So he was commissioned by revolutionaries in Connecticut to lead the Green Mountain Boys and take Fort Ticonderoga, which happened to be in New York, but that was not a problem for Ethan Allen. And that provided the artillery that Washington was able to use the next spring, thanks to Henry Knox dragging it across the route of the present Mass Pike on sleds in the wintertime, to drive the British out of Boston.
Then, just fast-forwarding a little bit, Ethan Allen's military career came to a pretty anticlimactic end. He took his men north and tried to take Montreal?
Well, he was voted out by the conservative landowners in Vermont right after his heroic attack on Ticonderoga. So he went on his own as a scout and raised French Canadians and some people from the Berkshires of Massachusetts. And he tried to take Montreal, a fortified city with 3,000 people in it and British troops and artillery. He tried to take it with 134 men. It
134 men. Was he, what was he thinking? Were you able to turn that up in your research?
Well, he was thinking that the Green Mountain Boys, under their new commander, Seth Warner, who had been elected the new commander, was going to show up with 500 Green Mountain Boys, and they never did. He crossed the St. Lawrence River, and they didn't.
So that's all quite a life for one person to have lived, but everything that we've just been talking about is only just one side of Ethan Allen. When he wasn't fighting or founding states and stuff, he was writing. He was a philosopher who in many ways laid the groundwork for people like Thomas Paine.
He started writing when he was 19, and a lifelong habit of questioning the clergy. He defended a minister who was backsliding to become a Church of England man again. And he kept writing, mostly for the newspapers in Hartford, but they were circulated all over what is now Vermont, all over New England. As the struggle against New York increased, he wrote his first book-length manuscript in 1772. After he was captured, captured by the British and held a prisoner in horrible conditions for 34 months. He came out and he wrote a narrative of his own captivity, which became the second best-selling book of the Revolution, only behind Tom Paine. And then he went on writing. He wrote a book I discovered that everybody else just thought was a pamphlet, but Ethan Allen couldn't write a pamphlet. He wrote 178 pages attacking New York again, another full-length book. And his last long work, an impenetrable piece of theology and philosophy, Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, was a frontal attack, Ethan Allen style, on the clergy of New England. That got him run out of Bennington. He printed 1,500 copies. 1,300 went up in smoke in a mysterious fire. So he moved and built a little cabin, a homestead in Burlington, Vermont, where he spent his last 5 years writing an appendix to it. That wasn't enough.
As we mentioned, Ethan Allen is commonly called the founding father of Vermont, but the state of Vermont was created after his death. And at the end of his life, you write, Ethan Allen actually opposed statehood for Vermont, or at least he was ambivalent about it.
Well, I think he was more ambivalent about taking on the debts of the rest of the states. They had not paid their Revolutionary War debts, and if Vermont were let in, they would have to pay a share of the whole national debt. So he was opposed to that. He fooled the British, though, for about 3 years into thinking that he was going to hand Vermont over to the British instead. Actually, he was powerless politically by that time of his life. And he wanted basically to be able to trade with Canada, the first free trade with Vermont, or with New York, and he wanted equal status for Vermonters with New York. New York wouldn't sign off on it. It was deeply personal. By the time he died, most Vermonters didn't want to hear his name anymore. But as soon as he died, negotiations took place, and Vermonters actually did have to pay off the leading land claimants of New York, including the first mayor of New York City after the Revolution, James Duane, until they got their own clear title.
Well now, today, what place does Ethan Allen occupy in the public consciousness of Vermont? You're speaking to us from the Burlington area now.
I think he's the real frontier hero of the Revolution. And he's also, I think, the role model for people who have to start over. He had to start over. Vermont has become a place where people know that whatever they've been through or whatever their political views or their religious backgrounds are, you can go to Vermont and start over. So I think that idea of resilience, of having a second chance, is the legacy of Ethan Allen.
As we said earlier, Will, your book is the first big bio of Ethan Allen to come out in a half century. At our office at Radio Boston, we can't take three steps without tripping over a new founding father bio or a revolutionary history book that some publisher has sent to us. It seems like there's an insatiable demand for this stuff, especially in our part of the country. Why do you think there's been no love for Ethan Allen up until now?
Well, because he's been turned into a mythical hero. Unbelievable. And Vermonters have had a lot to answer for it. I was going to write about Ethan Allen, they made a gesture that looked like turning a mug upside down and taking a long drink. They've turned him into one part Daniel Boone, one part Paul Bunyan, and two parts Jack Daniels. And so they've made him a comic book figure, a caricature of what he really was, because he was much more complicated than any of that. They didn't read him. And he was the best read author in Vermont before the Civil War. 60 editions of his prisoner of war narrative came out before the Civil War, and inspired Vermonters to enlist at highest per capita rate in the Union Army in the Civil War. So they just didn't know about him. They don't even learn about him in school still.
Well, I certainly learned about him in your new book, Ethan Allen, His Life and Times. Willard Stern Randall, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Freedom seeds, sir, to feed a hungry nation with freedom for all. Oh, the mountains sing and the valley.
And before we go, an update on the earthquake that rattled much of the eastern seaboard this afternoon. The 5.9 magnitude quake was centered northwest of Richmond, Virginia. And in the last hour, the FAA has issued a hold order on planes headed for Dulles International Airport, John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, and planes also headed to Philadelphia. Andrews Air Force Base is also closed to air traffic. In Massachusetts, state police say they've received no reports of injuries or significant structural damage. John Ebel is director of the Western Observatory at Boston College, and he says geologists are monitoring for aftershocks.
there's always this very, very slight chance, and I would put it as remote, that an even larger earthquake could occur in the same area within the next few days or weeks, that this might be a foreshock.
More earthquake coverage coming up on All Things Considered.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from theangleofboston.com. I'm Adam Ragusea.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.